Welcome to another episode of the Growth Focus Podcast, where we bring together tech leaders from across the globe who are willing to share their time, their energy, their insights, and their expertise so that we may all grow in our businesses. My name is Gary Lafferty, your host. I am the founder and creator of the Authority Accelerators, where we drive profits and revenues for our tech partners by elevating experts in their field to the authority status so that they can do the choosing of their clients rather than being the one that's chosen all the time. On this episode, I'm extremely excited to have Dr. Gordon Jones with us, and we're going to be talking about building companies from the scratch up, existings, exits, lessons learned, and pickleball of all things. So we've got a really interesting episode here. So without further ado, Dr. Gordon Jones, it's fantastic to have you here. Why don't you kick off by introducing yourself, about who you are, and what is it that you do currently?
So Gordon Jones, I'm in Augusta, Georgia. If anybody knows where that is, it's where the Masters Golf Tournament is played. And I am the founder and CEO of CloneYourself.cc. I'm also vice president of ecosystems with Pickle Zone, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure, as well. And so that's basically me today. I had supposedly retired back in 22, so I'm still working, evidently.
Yeah. Well, it's a good job you are, because it's brilliant having you here. So let's talk about this career. You've had a fascinating career. You know, you're from scaling health tech startups to now being involved in blockchain and sports tech. Just as a common thread, what in the most simplistic terms, what has been the commonality between all of your careers, your career roles, and where, how does it link in towards today?
So I can't focus on one thing.
Let's start with you. You got your career. You went from health. Why don't we start from? Let's talk about you when you started doing your health tech startups. All right. We're going to talk a lot about failing fast, learning from mistakes and whatnot. What got you into tech in the first place?
So in the early 90s, I had my doctorate, my master's, my doctorate in health administration. And so in the early 90s, managed care was managed care, where we're actually trying to manage the care of patients. It's a healthcare plan model here in the United States for all those that are not here. And that was really getting kicked off in the early 90s. And I was helping physicians to figure out how to deal with this, because it was administration. It wasn't the care of patients. So what ultimately ended up happening was I figured out that we needed to leverage the emerging information technology that was coming out. The internet had just kind of really gotten started itself, much less any applications built on it. And so that's where I made the jump. In 1997, I made the jump over to health tech. That was while I was getting my doctorate. So I was actually able to do my doctoral research on healthcare's adoption of the internet to communicate with patients. Mm. I published that in 2001, ultimately. So that's how I made the jump. And then from health tech, I just expanded into whatever else kind of came along that I'm an early adopter. And so sometimes I get too early.
Let's talk about that, because this is what I love. And when we were talking before, you know, this is what I thought, do you know what? I need to get him on this podcast, because it's a fascinating story, right? Because I love what you said there. You're an early adopter, and everyone hears the term early adopter, but no one really tends to have the consequences of early adopters, right? You've had several exits, not all of them great. Right, there's been failure, and this is where most people don't want to talk about. They don't want to talk about the failures of stuff, but there are lessons to be learned from failing, from those exits.
That's so, where you learn your lessons.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you fail fast, you get back up again, and you hopefully do not repeat the same things that you did before. So would you say is for those who are listening here who are too scared of failure, what is the most valuable lesson you've learned from failed ventures, and why people shouldn't be fearful of failure?
Marry well. And I don't mean financially, I mean forgiving.
Yeah.
So my wife forgives me for all of my failures. So that's what allows me to just keep jumping in. So that I would say that's the number one. The other one is, so I grew up a military brat. I went to the Citadel, which is a military college, like the West Point of the South here. I went in the 82nd Airborne Division. I jumped out of the airplanes. So I just have always done stupid stuff. So it's kind of inbred in me. But what I try to teach my clients, my mentees, and also my employees is that, hey, I don't care if you fail, just try it and we'll see what happens. And, you know, let's work together through the process so that we can try to avoid the failure if we can. But if we do fail, like you said, fail fast and move on to the next thing. And I've scared a lot of people. I mean, there's a lot of people in the family that have been worried about me. And, so I've proven them wrong, thank God. But so the naysayers are out there. You just have to let it go in one ear and out the other and be respectful to them, but you don't have to listen to them. So.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Because you've also had some great successes. You know, people, you don't have to dwell on the failures as long as you get back up again, dust yourself off, you know, and keep on moving. I mean, you can't fail or succeed if you don't keep moving. So the fact is that you carry on moving. You've had some great successes. You've taken companies from startup to IPO. So in your career, so what are the critical factors of scaling a company beyond its earlier years? Because that's when most founders tend to get a little bit stuck, you know, that they've got all the energy going into the early part of it, and then they just hit this glass ceiling. They don't even know it half the time, but they just tend to plateau. What kind of critical factors would you say is absolutely necessary to break through that and get that to the next stage?
If you don't bring an operator in as your co-founder, then bring them in within a year, or within 2 years for sure. You can get it to scale, start your early hockey stick. But once the operations and the processes are in place, you got to have an operator whose mindset is thinks that way, because I don't think that way at all. I'm not an operator.
So define an operator for those who are listening and go, oh, okay, what does that actually mean?
So a person who understands how the processes of an operations, whatever those operations are, they're your daily ongoing things that your company has to do. Your employees are in some cases doing over and over and over again every day. So you need somebody to keep those going and be efficient so that you can ultimately earn a profit. And it takes a totally different mindset than from somebody who's a creator.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think especially in tech, a lot of it is creative. And I've said this many, many times before, not just on this channel, but on other places as well, that a lot of tech tends to fall for this build it and they will come, field of dreams mentality. This is what that's what they created. My baby's the best and they're all going to flood towards me. What insights or what advice would you give to founders who have found themselves or perhaps don't even know they're doing it of this, spending so much time in the cutting edge of their product or their service, but not spending enough time in the go-to-market phase to grow their company?
So nobody wants what you're building because you're building it for yourself, right? And okay, sometimes there's a problem that you have you can solve that the market will take up to. But for the most part, the creatives, which are including the coders that are creating the tech products, I promise you 99% of the time, what you're building, if you're building it by yourself for yourself, the market is not going to, there's not going to be a fit in the market for it.
Yeah.
So that's probably the primary thing I would say is that you need to have people around you who are not just yes men or just people who will do the task you order them to do. They've got to be people that'll push back. And so there's a little bit of market in there. I would say it's more market analyst people in the early stage, not marketers per se, because marketers, they just take what you've created and try to sell it, that for the most part. So the analysts up front are going to help you assess kind of what the market is looking for. And then you like we talked about, you want to cycle and fail fast. So you're iterating in order to ultimately get to what we call your product market fit, right? So where that's what your industry, your market wants, whether it's a B2B or a B2C model, either case.
Yeah, we see miles too often, you know, founders are looking at it and they're spending so much time almost like the best kept secret, because they keep iterating in their head and fiddling around when they haven't even taken it out there, like you said, to take the analysts out. Go, look at them. Is it going to fit with the market? What does the market want? Bring it back. Reiterate. Fail it. Get it back out there. This constant thing is how you hone and hone fast and getting it to help so you can make sure when it comes out into the marketplace is exactly what they want, not what you think they want. You know, and that's a really, really key point when it comes thing. So when it comes to you've done a lot with your industry and your careers before, but you've worked in industries that were ahead of their time. You've worked with people, the adoption of healthcare, now blockchain in sports. How do you position, in your opinion, how do you position a company to stand out and gain trust when market isn't really fully mature yet? It's all well and good when it's a mature market. That's hard enough. But when the market's not mature yet, how do you stand out and, more importantly, gain trust?
So the ones that have been successful, I found a partner who's already in the space. And this just is an add-on to what they're already doing that they don't have, that they can just bring you right into their channel. That's the one that's been the most successful for me, even though I did have, it wasn't really a failure, but it was more an absorption as opposed to a exit. So right after the iPhone was created, I developed a live streaming platform called Guardian Watch, which was created so that people who see a 911 incident going on in here in the United States, 911 is fire, police, or EMS, medical. And so they see it, they're walking down the street, they see it going on. Not only do they dial the 911 number and report, but now they can live stream video so that the first responders can see what's going on at the location before they even get there.
Yeah.
It helps them with resource management, but it also helps them like in a domestic violence case. That's the number one case where police get hurt is entering a domestic violence, because a husband and wife could be fighting, but as soon as the cop gets there, they're fighting. Both of them are fighting the cops together. So it's not a good thing. So that's one of the reasons why we built that. And I partnered with the company in the United States that processes 85 to 90% of all 911 phone calls. So whether you're on a mobile device, your landline at home, you're on a voice over IP phone, or even a satellite phone, you dial 911, it goes to them, they figure out where you are, and then they route it to your local police station or your public safety access point is what we call it, PSAP. And so they were the world's largest, because they did that for the whole United States, Canada, almost all of North America. And so they were my partner, and we deployed it. It was working and everything. And the problem was the backbone of the 911 system was ancient, hadn't been upgraded. They couldn't agree on standards, which is one of the reasons why. And so they couldn't deploy it through that system. So it worked on a local basis whenever I did some kind of arrangement with a local public safety access point or police department or fire department or whatever. But that company called Entrato, they couldn't embed a video stream in the existing infrastructure. So even today, that was in 2011, 2012. And even today, we still can't do that.
Yeah. I mean, that really goes to show then, doesn't it, that you can create something which is really a fantastic product. You develop something, but there just isn't the need or the ability of the market to use it for you to monetize it. You know, so getting it out to the marketplace via yourself or via partners is actually a really smart thing to do for speed, because you well, need that.
That was kind of a failure, but that was because the industry standards. One that did succeed was in the same kind of vein. We created a mobile application for the EM tech, the emergency tech in the field, to be able to enter data on a mobile device that's strapped to their leg while they're seeing the patient. And that information gets to the emergency department in the hospital that they're going to transfer it to.
Mm-hmm.
And we partnered with the Georgia Hospital Association with that one, and they deployed it in all 1,700 EMS entities across the state of Georgia. So in that partnership, that model worked.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you actually have to try, right? And just see what happens. And usually that model works a lot better. Trying to be B2C is really, really hard. I don't know how to do that very well. And so B2B is what I've always tried to focus
on. For those listening here today, they'll be thinking, yeah, I've been thinking about partnerships. I keep hearing this, you know, got to build partnerships. That's my easy access to a massive client list. What advice would you be giving to these founders who are listening or about building these relationships, finding a relationship? Because, you know, they tend to make the mistake of, my product is so great, they're going to love it, and I just have to sit back and it'll just come pouring in. What advice would you give to founders who are looking to find and secure good partnership agreements?
You have to build your reputation in your industry. I've done that on LinkedIn. So I've got followers on LinkedIn, primarily focused on my industry, which initially was health tech, and then get into emerging tech like blockchain and identity, decentralized identity, stuff like that, and now more AI. But establishing your reputation in your industry, that also includes your national associations and or your local associations, whatever your market is, wherever it is. That's the number one way, and trying to, so that your phone call is a warm call and not a cold call.
Yeah. And I think, you were saying, because I love what you said about LinkedIn, because obviously one of the things that my company does all the time is elevating experts in their field into authorities. And like you just say, you have to be known for what you do over and above everybody else from that. And LinkedIn is a fantastic way of doing it. How important do you think it is for tech founders who aren't quite ready to take it out to market yet to start thinking about building their authority?
Oh, well, so I don't believe that you build your company's brand on LinkedIn. You build your brand on LinkedIn. So don't even build a company page that you're going to then spend money to market that company page. Just focus on your personal brand. And you can start off with all your personal perspectives about the industry and things like that without giving away your idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
And commenting on others, they're posting their ideas or those companies that you're either going to compete with in the future or emulate or whatever. You can comment on their posts, making insightful. You're not demeaning them. You're just making insightful posts about what they're talking about and maybe even heightening them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that helps you build your reputation on LinkedIn, not only from the people that are on LinkedIn, but also within the LinkedIn algorithms too. So,
yeah, I think a lot of people just think that LinkedIn is a job seeking platform or somewhere to put it on. And so they don't really bother. And they don't really, one of the things I keep looking at is if you look at somebody's profile and you've approached somebody, I want to see who the CEO is, the CFO, the COO. And if they've just got this blank screen on their LinkedIn, I can't find anything about you on your website. And I of interest. So I go to LinkedIn because I want to see who the person is, like you say, what's the personal brand behind it? And that it's just not utilized enough. And it's just a fantastic tool to use to really
and, start building. And they'll look at your first connections too.
Yeah.
So they'll want to see like, okay, or is this guy hooked up? Is he a first connection with any VCs yet or anything like that? So especially if you're raising money.
Exactly. You know, that's a really, really good point. Let's talk about PickleZone now, because this is a fantastic thing. PickleZone is pioneering blockchain and AI technology in the sports world. You know, when you look more into it, that's what they're doing. Where do you see the biggest opportunities for blockchain, AI, gamification, and tech in sports today?
So I write a little bit about this in my book, AI and Sports. Not to personally plug anything, but so we're building tech that can be adopted across all sports. We're starting off with pickleball because pickleball as a sport in the United States has been around since 1965, but it's just now maturing as a national sport that everybody's talking about. But there's no tech platform that is its standard for anything. And so we're using pickleball as a way to build what we want to build for the sports industry in an environment that is that where we can get, I mean, there's 34 million people that play pickleball. And so there's all these companies who are trying to attract those people and we want to serve them. And so we're doing that through AI. Primarily, we've cloned Scott Moore. He's the winningest world champion pickleball player. He's in the Pickleball Hall of Fame. People don't even know there's such thing as a Pickleball Hall of Fame. And so we've cloned him. So you can actually go to picklezone.com and talk to Scott Moore and ask him questions about pickleball. Just learn it, learn what the rules are, or actually ask specific questions about what kind of serve is best in what scenarios. So that's pretty cool. The other thing that we're looking to do, and we're not going to build it ourselves, we're probably going to partner because there's three companies doing this part of it, but it's the Vision AI where you can record your match play with the camera, mobile or static, and then the AI will analyze your play. Okay, how many serves did you win? Where'd the ball strike? You know, what is you're moving up to the, what we call the kitchen line, the net, you know, where are you on the court? I mean, it can grab all of that data and analyze it for you. And so we're not going to build that piece. We want to partner with that one, but what we want to do is merge them together. So the Vision AI is capturing all these statistics from the match, and then it feeds it to Scott Moore, and he understands what's going on and can give you real-time feedback while you're playing, just like your coach would if he was on the side watching the match. So that's our ultimate goal on the AI side within pickleball, and then we'll just take that into all other sports is our plan.
Yeah.
Where we're bringing in blockchain is we're so on the AI side, there's a lot of data there that there's IP around this data. We want to protect it. So accessing that data will be channeled through a blockchain application so we can keep track of our data and know who we've given permission to access it and when they access it, what they're accessing and what they're doing with it afterwards. So that's what we're using blockchain for. Now on the other side of it, we're also creating a token for the sport of pickleball. And this is where the gamification comes in. We want to basically create an ecosystem that adopts this as a reward system. So when you want to challenge, when I want to challenge you in a match of pickleball, I can go to the app and I can see what your rating is. And let's say you're a 5-0 and I'm a 3-0. So that means you're a better player than I am. But I want to play you because I want to learn. So I can wager you $40 to play me in a match to where if if you win, I pay you 40, but if I win, you pay me 10. So you're willing to put back 10, but you know you're going to win anyway. So it's basically a way that I can incentivize you to play me so that I can get better and you can make some dough. Okay.
Yeah.
Or you can use those reward tokens to go buy stuff at like Picklezone, pickleball.com, you know, where you can buy paddles and all that kind of stuff. So, so that's what we're doing on the other side of the blockchain ledger is this token that that can float through the whole ecosystem that we want ultimately the rating system to use, the retail guys to use, the Major League Pickleball guys to use, so that people are just adopting this token and we're moving away from cash, USD, because we're all over the world. I mean, we're in 80 countries now, not Pickle Zone, but Pickleball is in 80 countries now. So now this one currency could be for all pickleball, no matter where you are in the world.
Yeah.
That's the other really cool thing that we're doing.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I'm listening. My brain can't help thinking, wow, what other sports could this all work for? You know, whether it be golf or whether it be football, American football, or whether it be, you know, that there's just so much out there that's available. And I'm glad you guys are at the pioneering side of it. This is a bit of a loaded question as your final question. If with all your experience that you've had within the industries that you've been in, if you had to give your younger self one piece of advice about growing a company that was an absolute non-negotiable piece of advice, what would that be?
Well, I think I mentioned it before, and that's finding a good partner. So it doesn't necessarily have to be your wife. It could be your partner and your founding partner in your company. But if it is not your wife, whoever it is, you're going to be married to them, right? So and we have processes. If you got an incubator, you probably have this inside your incubator. It's like, okay, guys, we got to go through marriage counseling together to find out before we sign this partnership agreement, because you know we're going to argue. The VCs might get in the middle of us and start figuring out who they want to take down the track, right? If you look at the Facebook model.
Yeah.
And so that's the number one thing is like, first of all, you do need to have a team. You can't do anything by yourself, but if it's a co-founder, you need to make sure you guys gel, you're on the same page, you have the same vision, and you feel comfortable with the strengths that each of you bring to the table, that you know, you're not going to be jealous of each other, or you're not going to be ticked off that your partner's not carrying his own weight, his or her own weight, whatever. So that's probably the main thing. I mean, that's in all of my exits or in failures and everything. A lot of it's been really based on that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a fantastic piece of advice to end this episode on. Gordon, thank you very much for your time today and sharing all those insights, you know, and your experiences. It's truly been honorable today. Thank you very much.
Yeah, man. So if anybody's out there wants to reach out to me on LinkedIn, it's Dr. Gordon Jones. Real easy to find me.
I'll make sure that link is in the show notes so they can get in touch with you. So thank you,
Gary, man. It was a great time. You.
It's an absolute pleasure having you here. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us for yet another episode of the Growth Focus Podcast. If you've learned anything today, please make sure you like it, you comment, but more importantly, please make sure you share so that other people can take the insights that Gordon has shared with us and grow their companies as well. So until next time, take care, keep pushing forward, all the very best, and we shall see you on the next episode. Bye-bye.
All right.